From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Today, the convening authority for military commissions received sworn charges against six individuals alleged to be responsible for the planning and execution of the attacks upon the United States of America, which occurred on September the 11th, 2001.
6.5 years after 9/11, the Pentagon files charges against six men for their alleged role in the attacks. Was the evidence obtained through torture? We'll speak with Vincent Warren, the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. We'll also be joined by filmmaker Alex Gibney. His Oscar-nominated documentary, Taxi to the Dark Side, investigates U.S. torture. It was just dropped by Discovery Channel, saying it's too controversial. Then 2006 Nobel Peace Laureate Muhammad Yunus.
Poverty is the absence of all human rights. The frustrations, hostility, and anger generated by abject poverty cannot sustain peace in any society.
Muhammad Yunus received the Nobel for his pioneering program of giving microcredit loans to the poor. He'll join us in our Firehouse studio to talk about his new book, Creating a World Without Poverty, Social Business and the Future of Capitalism. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Defense Secretary Robert Gates has announced he supports stalling a limited withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq set for the summer. Gates made the statement during a surprise visit to Iraq on Monday.
Well, I think that the notion of a brief period of consolidation and evaluation probably does make sense.
How brief would that be?
Well, that's one of the things that we're still thinking about.
The Bush administration had previously touted the summer withdrawals as a key sign of progress in Iraq. In other Iraq news, two journalists with CBS News have been kidnapped in the southern city of Basra. Their names have not been released, but they've been identified as a British citizen and an Iraqi. In Washington, D.C., the Pentagon announced the filing of capital charges against six Guantanamo prisoners Monday for their alleged roles in the 9/11 attacks. Brigadier General Thomas Hartman said the defendants would be tried before a military commission at Guantanamo.
Chief Prosecutor has requested that the charges be tried jointly and that they be referred as capital for each defendant. If the convening authority, Mrs. Susan Crawford, in her sole discretion, decides to refer the cases as capital, the defendants will face the possibility of being sentenced to death.
The prisoners, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, has admitted to masterminding the 9/11 attacks and several other crimes, but his statements have been called into question over the nature of his interrogation and his possible motives in protecting others who could have been involved. The CIA has admitted to waterboarding Mohammed in a secret prison. Pentagon investigators concluded in 2005 another of the accused, Mohammed al-Qahtani, was also subjected to abusive treatment at Guantanamo. The military commissions themselves have come under criticism. Jennifer Daskal of Human Rights Watch said the 9/11 trials would have no legitimacy in a secretive military court.
These are not fair commissions, and in order for the verdict to have any sort of legitimacy here in the United States or abroad, it's absolutely essential that the convictions be brought through a system that is established, that has precedent that's been relied on and built on and developed over the years, and that will have the credibility that the federal court system has. And the military commission system has just failed to meet that test.
We'll have more on the 9/11 charges after headlines. On the campaign trail, Virginia, Maryland, and the District of Columbia hold contests today in what's known as the Potomac primary. Senator Barack Obama is expected to follow his weekend sweep of the five states with another string of wins. On Monday, Obama gave his setup speech to a large crowd at the University of Maryland.
This is our time. And if you will stand with me, if you will work alongside with me, if you vote for me on Tuesday, then I promise you this, we will not just win Maryland, we will win the Democratic nomination, we will win the general election, and you and I together, we will go forward to change this country and change the world.
The Clinton campaign is already looking ahead to several key primaries next month, including Texas and Ohio. Also campaigning in Maryland, Hillary Clinton said she was the best candidate to defeat Republican frontrunner John McCain.
Because it's going to take all of us to win in November. There is absolutely no guarantee that we're going to be able to just assume that everyone knows how badly we need a change. We're going to have to work for it. We're going to have to make the case. Senator McCain apparently is the Republican nominee, and he will run a very aggressive and vigorous campaign. I mean, we have to start imagining right now what it will take for our nominee to go toe-to-toe with John McCain on national security, on defense, on homeland security.
East Timor has declared a state of emergency following an assassination attempt on its two top leaders. President José Ramos Horta is said to be in serious but stable condition after rebel soldiers shot him Monday in a pre-dawn attack. Prime Minister Xanana Gusmão was also targeted, but he was not injured. Ramos Horta is being treated in an Australian hospital in Darwin. Dr. Len Notara said the East Timorese leader is lucky to be alive.
Look, we would be very hopeful of a good recovery. This is a very traumatic and a nasty event. High-velocity, high-powered weapons shooting somebody in the chest and indeed the abdomen are nasty injuries. But we would be very hopeful and cognizant of a good recovery.
José Ramos Horta won the Nobel Peace Prize for helping to lead East Timor's bid against Indonesian occupation. He served as prime minister and president since East Timor's independence. In Japan, a U.S. Marine has been arrested for the alleged rape of a 14-year-old Japanese girl on the southern island of Okinawa. Japanese Prime Minister Yasuo Fukuda announced the charges against the Japanese parliament.
It is unforgivable. Despite the fact that these kinds of crimes have occurred in the past, the same kind of thing occurred again. We have to take it seriously.
The announcement made before the Japanese parliament. Some 50,000 U.S. troops are stationed in Japan, most of them in Okinawa. In Israel and the occupied territories, the Israeli government's announced plans to build 1,000 new Jewish-only homes in East Jerusalem. Israel's previously agreed to halt settlement activity under the U.S.-backed roadmap, but it now claims the freeze only applies to those settlements it doesn't want to keep. The announcement comes 2 months after Israel said it would build new homes in the Jewish settlement of Har Homa near Jerusalem. Venezuela is in a new spat with the U.S. government following a court victory freezing the Venezuelan state oil company's foreign assets and bank accounts. The oil giant ExxonMobil won the order as part of an attempt to recoup an investment in a Venezuelan oil project nationalized last year. More than $12 billion in Venezuelan assets were frozen, even though Exxon's investment was valued at between $2 to $4 billion. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez has threatened to cut off U.S. oil exports unless the freeze is lifted. In California, the health insurance giant Blue Cross is coming under criticism for trying to enlist physicians and denying patients medical care. The Los Angeles Times reports Blue Cross has sent doctors copies of health insurance applications filled out by new patients. The doctors are then asked to immediately notify Blue Cross if the applications omit any pre-existing conditions that could be used to deny them coverage. Blue Cross is California's largest for-profit health insurer. Observers say the letter could provide conflicts for doctors who rely on Blue Cross for most of their income. Anthony Wright of Health Access California said, quote, they're playing a game of gotcha where they are trying to use their doctors against their patients' health interests. That's about as ugly as it gets, he said. The Justice Department has announced the arrest of four people accused of passing on military information to China. The suspects include a former engineer with the defense contractor Boeing. In business news, the internet search giant Yahoo has rejected a $44 billion takeover bid from Microsoft. Analysts expect Microsoft to boost its offer as it tries to take on leading search giant Google. And Democratic Congressmember Tom Lantos of California has died. He was 80 years old. Lantos was the only survivor of the Nazi Holocaust to win a seat in Congress. In 2002, he was a leading backer of the congressional measure authorizing the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 6.5 years after 9/11, the Pentagon announced Monday it's charging six prisoners at Guantanamo with conspiracy to commit war crimes for their alleged involvement in the attacks. Military prosecutors are seeking the death penalty for the six men. Pentagon legal advisor Brigadier General Thomas Hartman made the formal announcement at a news conference Monday.
Today, the convening authority for military commissions received sworn charges against six individuals alleged to be responsible for the planning and execution of the attacks upon the United States of America, which occurred on September the 11th, 2001. The chief prosecutor has requested that the charges be tried jointly and that they be referred as capital for each defendant. If the convening authority, Mrs. Susan Crawford, in her sole discretion, decides to refer the cases as capital, the defendants will face the possibility of being sentenced to death.
Rights groups brought up the question of evidence obtained from torture, particularly with respect to two of the six men being charged, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Mohammed al-Qahtani. The CIA recently admitted to waterboarding Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and Pentagon investigators concluded in 2005 Qahtani had been subjected to aggressive interrogation methods at Guantanamo. During his news conference at the Pentagon yesterday, Brigadier General Hartman was questioned about the admissibility of evidence obtained through torture.
Can you tell us, was any of the information that was derived from aggressive interrogations of either KSM or any of the other five defendants used in preferring these charges?
I don't know the answer to that question. The prosecutors will make a determination about what evidence they are going to produce in the case in chief. I haven't seen the files yet, and that will identify to us what evidence is used. But let me be clear. We are a nation of law and not of men. And the question of what evidence will be admitted, whether waterboarding or otherwise, will be decided in the courts, in front of a judge, after it's fought out between the defense and the prosecution in these cases. That's the rule of law. That's the procedure that Congress has provided to us, and that's what we will use to finally answer these questions.
But just based on, excuse me, a follow-up, but just based on your own legal expertise, is that kind of evidence normally permissible against the defendant if it's achieved through duress?
Well, I'll answer the same question. This issue is not based upon my legal experience. This issue is based upon the rule of law. And the military judge will decide if this evidence is going to be admitted. That's the procedure we have set up. That's the American standard of justice that the court decides, the judge decides. In this process, and it's quite a unique process, if the accused is found guilty of anything, he gets an automatic right of appeal to the Court of Military Commission Review, very similar to the military process, but very dissimilar to any other process. It's an extra right for the accused in this case. And in addition, let me say this, before he even gets to that, his sentence and the charges would again be reviewed by the convening authority. Again, another right that doesn't exist anywhere on earth except in the military system. So it's an extraordinary set of rights that we're providing to the accused. And just so you know, at Nuremberg, there were no rights of appeal.
In fact, the military process here, you basically have to take whatever the intelligence community tells you at face value. You have no independent means of discovery on the U.S. intelligence community.
Well, we receive whatever evidence we receive it from the various communities in the law enforcement intelligence community, and we use that evidence and proceed with the evidence that's been provided. It's been a very cooperative effort.
Brigadier General Thomas Hartman responding to questions at a Pentagon news conference Monday. Journalists also brought up the issue of torture with White House Press Secretary Dana Perino at a separate news conference later in the day.
Dana, is the White House at all concerned that some of the evidence of the confessions by any of these men may not be admissible because they were obtained through waterboarding, which the administration admitted to last week?
Kathleen, I'm not going to be able to comment about the trial from this podium, so I'm not able to comment on that, but I'm sure that if you call the Department of Defense, they'll be able to talk about it further.
What about the timing of all this? Again, it was just Thursday that the Vice President Hayden admitted the United States had used waterboarding against some of these suspects. And then, lo and behold, Monday, the DOD announces they're going forward on these cases.
I can see conspiracy written all over your face, but there was none. And this decision, that, as the military said, that they were ready to bring the charges, and they did that today when they were ready.
So it's a mere coincidence, though.
As I said this morning, yes.
One more. Following up on that, though, when the president made his decision initially to authorize the interrogation of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the other two, did he weigh the possibility of criminal prosecutions and the admissibility of evidence?
I don't know, Mark. Obviously, you're talking about time frames that are years and years ago. I don't know.
Does the filing of charges against the 9/11 suspects bring the administration any closer to shutting down Guantanamo?
Well, the issue of shutting down Guantanamo Bay is separate from the issue of this trial.
White House Press Secretary Dana Perino answering journalists' questions Monday. The Center for Constitutional Rights represents Guantanamo prisoner Mohammed al-Khatani, one of the six men charged with war crimes connected to September 11th. Vincent Warren is executive director of CCR, joining us here in the Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now! The significance of these trial in a military commission tribunal.
Amy, the purpose of having a trial is to really to seek two things, truth and justice. And with this military commission process set up by the government, you're going to find neither. There's going to be neither truth nor justice. These commissions are based on the use of secret evidence, of evidence obtained by torture and by abusive tactics. And that it's based on hearsay, the idea that you can convict someone based upon what someone else said. And these are very clear prohibitions against secret evidence, torture, and hearsay evidence in a normal trial setting. But this is going to be the currency of this particular process.
Who established the rules in this military tribunal?
Initially, the military commissions process was set up by executive order by George Bush, and a fellow by the name of Salim Handan, who was charged under that commission, filed the lawsuit, went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said that the president didn't have the authority to do that. Congress had to authorize it. And then with the Military Commissions Act passed last year, Congress authorized the military commissions, and the process was essentially set up by the Pentagon.
General Hartman said there's room for appeal.
There's room for appeal in this process as they've defined it. But, General Hartman is really misleading the American public about what's happening here. One of the things that he said, it wasn't in your clip, but I thought was really interesting. One of the great rights that he said that these detainees were going to have was a right to remain silent at trial. Let's just sort of think about it for a second. What that means is they didn't have the right to remain silent when the government was torturing them and interrogating them and abusing them. And so they can sit idly by during this commission's process and listen to the stream of evidence that was brought in against them through torture, and they have a right not to say anything about it. And it is an illusory right. You know, there's another point that is really important here. It's not part of the process is what happens when you're convicted, but the other part of the process is what happens if you're not. Military officials have said that even if these men are found not guilty, the government has no intention of letting them go. So the absolute best they can do, the best you can do in this military commissions, is to remain in jail for the rest of your life illegally. And, of course, the worst you can do is to be executed. These are sham show trials, and there is nothing about this that comports with due process.
And the evidence that you have of your own, CCR's own client being tortured?
We represent Mohammed al-Khatani, who, unlike some of these other men, was abused very, very drastically at Guantanamo Bay itself. And he was subjected to extreme temperatures and was isolated for a tremendous period of time. He was forced to wear women's underwear. He, of course, was interrogated well before any lawyer was able to come and talk with him. We have a situation in which you have to be concerned for the mental state of a lot of these men because they were just serially abused in order to get statements.
The CIA director, Michael Hayden, has confirmed the CIA waterboarded three prisoners in 2002 and 2003 and admitted that waterboarding may be illegal under current law. What does that mean?
Well, I think what they're trying to continue their facade to pretending, first of all, they're still pretending that waterboarding is not torture, but we have to look at this in steps. At first, they said that they didn't torture, which we know was a lie, and then they said that they didn't waterboard, which we know is a lie. Now they're saying that they do waterboard, but it's not clear that waterboarding was torture, and now they're saying it may be torture, but it might not have been torture under the rules a couple of years ago. What they're trying to do, I believe, is set up a situation where they use the legal framework that they used at the time to be able to avoid a legal classification of waterboarding as torture currently.
The CIA director also said that private contractors might have been involved in the waterboarding of prisoners.
Yes, that can hardly be surprising to anybody because this government has had a very distinct record of outsourcing torture and other abusive treatments to contractors.
Will the lawyers for the prisoners be raising the issue of torture?
There is no question in my mind that the issue of torture and the issue of secret evidence will be absolutely at issue as these commissions move forward.
And the whole question that has been continually now put to the Attorney General, Michael Mukasey, around waterboarding and if it's illegal, if it's torture, after a series of questions, he finally said he might consider it torture if it was done to him.
Yes, that's, you know, luckily that we've had some good questioning from the press about this. And I think, you know, the bottom line is this. You can pretend that waterboarding is not torture until you really confront what it involves. And it is clearly torture. And they can put lipstick on that pig all that they want, but waterboarding is torture. Torture is illegal, and it will be an issue in these military commissions.
I wanted to turn to the issue of the media. A new documentary called Taxi to the Dark Side was recently nominated for an Academy Award. The film investigates some of the most egregious abuses associated with the so-called war on terror, including the U.S. torture of prisoners.
Put people in a crazy situation, and people do crazy things.
People were being told to rough up Iraqis that wouldn't cooperate. We were also told they're nothing but dogs.
Interrogators were telling the guards, strip this guy naked, chain him up to the bed in an uncomfortable position, do whatever you can.
You had these young soldiers with very little training, just as the rules were changing, and they weren't told what the new rules were.
You start looking at these people as less than human, and you start doing things to them you would never dream of. And that's where it got scary.
It was only the night shift. There's always a few bad apples.
The brass knew. They saw him shackled and hooded, and they said, right on, y'all are doing a great job.
There were emails from FBI personnel down at Guantanamo saying, you won't believe what's going on down here. We've got to disassociate ourselves.
You have no right to a lawyer. You have no right to witnesses. You don't really know what the charges are, and you certainly don't know what the secret evidence is against you.
They saw an intentional decision taken at the height of the Pentagon to put out a fog of ambiguity.
Excerpts of Taxi to the Dark Side. The Discovery Channel bought the rights to the Oscar-nominated film and had planned on airing it. But this week, filmmaker Alex Gibney learned Discovery has dropped plans to air the film because it's, quote, controversial. Alex Gibney is the award-winning director, writer, and producer of Taxi to the Dark Side. He joined us about a week ago to talk about the Oscar-nominated film, but today he's back to respond to Discovery. What happened, Alex?
Well, it turns out that the Discovery Channel isn't so interested in Discovery. I mean, I heard that I was told a little bit before my Academy Award nomination that that they had no intention of airing the film, that new management had come in and they were about to go through a public offering. So it was probably too controversial for that. They didn't want to cause any waves. Discovery turns out to be the See No Evil, Hear No Evil channel.
They bought the rights, though.
They did.
They own it.
They own the rights for the next 3 years. They own the broadcast rights. It's currently playing in theaters where people can see it. But we had hoped that it would have a broad airing on television. And indeed, you know, one of the reasons I went with Discovery was because they told me, look, we love this film. We're going to give it a broad and very prominent airing.
But if they still own the rights, can they just not air it for 3 years and keep you from airing it anywhere else?
Yes, they can. That's their right, because they paid for it. Now, we're hoping that they'll agree to sell it to somebody else, you know, maybe for a profit, if they need to do that. But I'm hoping at the very least that they'll allow somebody else to take it on so it can be shown to the American people.
And this comes just before the Oscars.
That's right.
The film opens with a taxi driver. Say briefly, though we talked about it last week, though, for those listeners and viewers who might not have watched it, and the significance now of Discovery not airing this.
Well, the film follows a taxi driver, an Afghan taxi driver, who was taken into American custody. And after, in the course of a 5-day interrogation, he was so badly beaten that he died. And indeed, the Army coroner classified it a homicide. We use the case of Dilawar, this young man, to look at the de facto and indeed sometimes stated policy of torture used by the Bush administration. And we follow, indeed, we also look at Mohammed al-Qahtani in Guantanamo and the interrogation techniques used on him there, the man who's now on trial through the military commission process.
So we get to see 24, well, perhaps when the writer's strike is over, where Jack Bauer tortures people right and left. But we don't get to see your film, Taxi to the Dark Side.
That appears to be the case now, and I'm hoping, like I say, that Discovery will relent and sell it to somebody else so we can see it. But at the moment, they appear to be sitting on it, and they've told us unambiguously that they have no intention of airing it. Indeed, they asked our distributor to take its logo off, but then when they were told how much it would cost, they said, okay, they'll leave the logo on.
Let me ask lawyer Vincent Warren the effect of popular awareness that comes through movies like Taxi to the Dark Side, if they get a showing on television, the effect that has in the legal arena and the kind of work that you do representing prisoners.
It is extremely important that Taxi to the Dark Side and other films like that are out there for, open for public view, because I think, as you were pointing out, this is government sponsored program of torture. We all know that it's happening, but the government is not telling us that. And it's up to filmmakers and up to reporters and journalists, people like Alex, people like yourself, to be able to get the information out there. It is literally the only way that we can have public currency about the issues. And let's remember that all of the concessions and admissions, such as they are by this government, were not done out of the goodness of their heart. They've been done by public pressure. They admit what they can't deny, and they deny what they can't admit. And as long as films like Taxi to the Dark Side are out there, it allows us to put pressure on this government to admit to what they've done, because they won't tell us that on their own.
Does the public have any role in this, Alex Gibney? Can have any effect on Discovery?
I hope so. I hope the letters and phone calls will start coming to Discovery and say, let us see the program.
But your film does go to the Oscars.
The film
Academy
does go to the
Awards
Oscars,
ceremony.
To the Academy Awards ceremony in a little less than 2 weeks, and it's in theaters now.
Well, Alex Gibney, I want to thank you for being with us, and congratulations on the Oscar nomination, not only for this, but you're also executive producer of No End in Sight, which another documentary that was nominated, Oscar nominated. I want to thank you both for being with us. Alex Gibney, Taxi to the Dark Side is his film. You can go to theaters, or perhaps you'll get to see it on television. Vincent Warren, executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. When we come back, we'll be joined by the Nobel Peace Laureate, Muhammad Yunus. Stay with us. DevGod Women's Collective here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting on over 650 stations on Pacifica and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting on our website at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish for any radio station to take us over 150 R. Banker to the poor. Muhammad Yunus is the Bangladeshi economist who was awarded the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize. Yunus shared the Nobel with the Grameen Bank, which he founded three decades ago. The microcredit program he pioneered has helped hundreds of thousands of impoverished Bangladeshis, mainly women, by providing small, unsecured loans, which are then repaid. Yunus accepted the Nobel Award in Oslo a little over a year ago.
Poverty is the absence of all human rights. The frustrations, hostility, and anger generated by abject poverty cannot sustain peace in any society. For building stable peace, we must find ways to provide opportunities for people to live decent lives. The creation of opportunities for the majority of the people, the poor, is at the heart of the work that we have dedicated ourselves during the past 30 years.
Muhammad Yunus is the first Nobel Peace Prize winner from Bangladesh. He's just come out with a new book called Creating a World Without Poverty, Social Business and the Future of Capitalism. Muhammad Yunus joins us for the rest of the hour in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Before we talk about microloans, I wanted to deal with this terrible issue that has just arisen in East Timor. A fellow Nobel Peace Prize laureate, José Ramos Horta, now in the hospital in Australia. He has survived an assassination attempt, two bullets to his chest and his stomach, though he's in very serious condition. You know José Ramos Horta.
I know him very well. He's a very good friend. I've known him long before he received the Nobel Peace Prize. He was a very enthusiastic supporter of microcredit. He's been pleading with me to come to East Timor to start a program, and I did when he was the prime minister. This is still running. I was shocked to hear this news, and I sent him a message, and we are all praying for his life and so that he comes back to full health.
For those of you who may have missed it, the president of East Timor, José Ramos Horta, as well as the prime minister, both there were assassination attempts on their life. Xanana Gusmão was not hit. José Ramos Horta was. Well, Muhammad Yunus, explain microcredit. Explain the whole idea behind the Grameen Bank.
The idea is overwhelming majority of the people in the world don't have access to financial services from the conventional financial institutions, the banks. So they are left to the loan sharks, moneylenders. So we know about moneylenders, loan sharks all the time. We read about them, we hear about them, but don't do anything about them. So it continues, it flourishes. So in one of my experience in Bangladesh, I saw an extreme situation in a village where money lending was still going on and people are becoming victims. So I wanted to address that issue in that village level. So I made a list of people who were borrowing from loan sharks. When my list was complete, there were 42 names on my list, and the total money they borrowed was $27. This is back in 1970s, early 70s. And I was shocked that for such a small amount of money, people have to go through such a horrible experience. So I thought, I can solve the problem. It's very easy. If I give this $27, they can return the money to the loan sharks and they'll be free. And that's what exactly I did. And it created such a sensation among them. I thought, if you can make so many people so happy with such a small amount of money, why shouldn't you do more of it? So I wanted to do more of it by linking them with the bank. Bank said, no, bank cannot lend money to the poor people. So I'm with this issue. Why can't the bank lend money to the poor people? So after months of struggle, finally I persuaded them by offering myself as a guarantor. I said, I'll sign all your papers, I'll take the risk, and you give the money. That was the beginning in 1976, and it worked. So gradually expanded the program, but banks were not very enthusiastic about it. So I thought, why don't I create a separate bank for them? So I created a separate bank, Grameen Bank, or a village bank, and then expanded and expanded. It doesn't need any collateral, first thing. No guarantee. no lawyers, no legal papers between the lender and the borrower. It's a trust-based banking. People, particularly women, take small loans who never did before, had any experience of handling money. But for the first time, she takes a little amount of money that she can organize her courage to do that, and then go into earning money by investing this money in raising chicken, doing some handicrafts and so on, and pay back the bank in weekly installments. That's what the microcredit is all about.
Why women?
I was complaining against the conventional banks. I said, why men? 100%, nearly 100% of the borrowers of conventional banks in Bangladesh are men. So I raised the issue. They are not only wrong by rejecting poor people, they are also wrong by rejecting women of all class. So when I began, I wanted to make sure half the borrowers in my program are women. So this is how I started. And it took a long time because women themselves said, no, don't give the money to me. I don't know anything about money. Give it to my husband. I said, no, that's not what we want. We want you to look at that. And we worked very hard to break the fear, because it's a fear that she was supposed to, I mean, she was hiding behind because she didn't want to touch money. This is trouble. So gradually we peel off the fear and build the confidence in her to try out with the small money, $20, $30 of loans. And it worked. She got very excited. She wanted more and continued in it. Once we achieved that goal of 50-50, then we saw money going to the family through women brought so much more benefit to the family compared to the benefit when you lend the money through men. Women took good care of the money. Women transferred the benefit to the children immediately, improved the household, and going towards a better life for themselves in a long-term vision. Men were mostly to enjoy right now, not in a long-term way, in a kind of a ready-made way, so sort of thing. So we changed our policy. We started focusing on women. Today we have 7.5 million borrowers in Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. 97% are women.
And who runs the bank? The bank is a for-profit.
Bank is a for-profit. It's owned by the borrowers. So the profit goes back to the borrowers again. So that way it's a full circle. It's a corporate body. It has a management team. And I head the management team. There's 27,000 plus employees, the staff of the bank, which go around the country to serve these 7.5 million borrowers and meet them physically within a week, because we do the business at the doorstep of the borrowers. So they don't have to come to our office. Office for us to keep the records, not for our business. So we do the business at the doorstep. So women feel very comfortable. She doesn't have to go any place. She do the business at her place and so on.
You have an interesting comparison in your book, Creating a World Without Poverty, to get a sense of the population density of Bangladesh. You squeeze all the people of the United States into Wisconsin, and it's still not as dense as Bangladesh.
That's right, yes. It's amazing at how density of population can happen in Bangladesh. Another way I explain, if you take the whole world population, bring it to the United States, density that it will create by putting 6 billion people in the United States. Today, density in Bangladesh is slightly higher than that. So you can imagine how much the density is.
And yet, since the Grameen Bank has been established, has the level of poverty changed in Bangladesh?
It has, it has. Poverty has been declining in Bangladesh very steadily. During the 90s, poverty has declined on an average of 1% per year.
About half the people are poor?
It used to be more than that, 80% poor, and gradually it's declining. We are one of those countries, I would say lucky countries in the world, which will be meeting the Millennium Development Goal number one to reduce poverty by half by 2015. So between 2000 and 2015, the poverty level in Bangladesh will be reduced to half. And if we can continue with our progress, most likely that we'll achieve that goal before 2015. So that's a tremendous kind of excitement for us.
Muhammad Yunus, what was the effect of winning the Nobel Peace Prize, you and the Grameen Bank, on the work that you do?
It's a wonderful thing. It's of all the prizes in the world, Nobel Prize is unique in its position. The tremendous amount of excitement it generates in the whole world about the prize. The moment the prize is announced, every single newspaper in the world makes it a front page news. Every television station is a main news item. And people get interested to know what you do, how you got it, what is it that you have done over the years. So it creates a lot of attention and awareness. We have been trying to explain why microcredit is so important for poor people to change their life, improve their income. But not too many people paid any attention to it. The moment the Nobel Peace Prize was announced, everybody wants to hear you, what you did, how you did. And everybody asks, how could we do more? Can we do something about it? So all the doors which you tried to knock and never open suddenly open, and people are willing to talk and go from there. So I'm taking to advantage of that, and now that I have the opportunity to discuss and explain, and it's so important it is in reduction of poverty. So I'm doing that, and I'm getting good response from people.
We're talking to Muhammad Yunus. He's the Nobel Peace Prize winner, founder and managing director of the Grameen Bank. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We'll be back with him in a minute. Nirtan Chal is a Bangladeshi dance troupe that performed in Oslo when our guest, Muhammad Yunus, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. His latest book is called Creating a World Without Poverty. He's the managing director of the Grameen Bank, which gives microloans to women in Bangladesh. He established it more than 30 years ago. Well, while everyone praises the cause of helping poor women in Bangladesh, some critics say microcredit is being misconstrued as a way of ending poverty. After you received the Nobel Peace Prize last year, we spoke with Vandana Shiva, the world-renowned environmental leader, physicist, ecologist. I wanted to play just an excerpt of what she had to say and then get your response. This is Vandana Shiva.
I'm very happy that the Grameen Bank and Yunus got the Nobel Peace Prize. I would only say, let us not think this is a solution to every situation that creates poverty. It's a solution in a particular context, but it cannot be the solution when land is being grabbed from the peasants and leaving them in poverty. For example, in this whole land grab under the special economic zones that's taking place in India right now, and foreign direct investment in real estate is part of the driving force for this. That cannot be solved by microcredit. It needs a solution in terms of respecting the land rights of the peasants and not treating land of the poor as something that can be grabbed by the rich. The recent report of Helsinki actually gives worse figures than Muhammad Yunus gave. 1% of the world's wealthy are owning 80% of the world's wealth. And I would say they're then turning that wealth into owning 80% of the world's resources, real material natural resources, the land, the water, the biodiversity, the forests, the minerals. I think there's a second context in which microcredit could actually create a problem. And it's the kind of context in which we've been forced to work as credit for unaffordable seeds moves non-renewable seeds, genetically engineered seeds, hybrid seeds into rural areas in India. We are seeing a new kind of debt trap created. Farmer suicides, of which there have been 150,000 in the last decade of market opening, made possible because of credit, micro and macro. 150,000 is a large number of peasants being wiped out. I have called this a genocide. And it's been made possible by putting money available, credit available, so that they could get seeds of Monsanto. And in fact, it's a debate, old debate I've had with Yunus, because there was a time he was going to use microcredit to move GM seeds and Monsanto seeds to the Bangladeshi women, and we had to have a debate, and thank goodness he backed out of that agreement.
But I remember this
credit
letter that you
wrote. Money circulation cannot solve the problems of alienation, of participating in Earth democracy. Privatization of water, leading to a high cost of water, could be financed by flows of credit, but the solution to access to water is rights to water. Rights cannot be substituted by credit. Rights need to be recognized as rights, and collective rights to the commonwealth of this planet, the atmosphere, the water, the seeds, the biodiversity, that needs a rights solution. Credit can come after that rights solution has been offered.
That is Vandana Shiva. Mohammed Yunus, your response.
Well, there are several things on that. One is a misinterpretation of microcredit. We are not saying that this is the solution for all poverty. We're saying this is an important item in solving poverty. Poverty is a multidimensional thing. It's not a single thing. So microcredit is a fundamental issue in bringing financial services to the poor people. What about the education? What about the health? What about the political rights? What about the human rights and so on? So all these things had to be brought in. So we deal with only one aspect, microcredit. And we are saying microcredit should be accepted as a human right. It's so fundamental, so basic thing to it. About the GMO, about the... we never did that.
This the is genetically a, modified seeds.
Genetically modified seed. This was also a misinterpretation. We were accused that we are giving microcredit to buy the genetically modified seeds. Grameen Bank works with women, with the landless families, extremely poor. They are not farmers. We do only with women, 97% women, only with landless people, extremely poor people. They are not anywhere near the farm owners, the farming. They don't buy seeds in the market. So we have no reason why we should give microcredit to them to buy the seeds when they don't have own land at all. So this is an extension to accuse Grameen Bank that they're doing the wrong thing.
But the idea that others would embrace it as a way to say this is bringing justice to very poor people when she says it's about access to water, not credit, that counts.
I was saying that everything is important. Access to credit is important. Access to water is important. Access to health is important. Access to education is important. Nothing is unimportant. I'm saying we do everything we can. Don't ignore the others. Just because you do one thing, so that the others are not important. Everything is important. So let's do it all together. That's what my new book, Creating a World Free from Poverty, is talking about. It's creating a different kind of system. It's poverty is not created by the poor people. Poverty is created by the system. System includes everything, the institution, the concept, the policies, and everything. So we're saying we have to address those things. We are, in our work in Grameen Bank, we are addressing the financial system. But there are many other systems which needs to be addressed.
Explain your idea of social business.
Yes, and I'm saying that the conceptual framework of the capitalism itself is at fault. That's where it created all the problems. So we have to address that also. And the concept of business, for example, only way the concept of business is defined in capitalist theory is a business to make money. Profit maximization is the sole mission of business. And I'm saying this is a misinterpretation of a human being. Human being is not a machine. Human being is not a robot. It's not a money-making machine. Human being is much bigger than making money. Money-making is an important part of a human being, but certainly it's not the totality of human being. Human being is much bigger than that. It wants to be a caring being. It's a sharing being. It wants to make a difference in the world. That part is not included in the business world, in the economic world.
Explain the example you begin creating a world without poverty with, and that is the Grameen-Danone relationship.
Sure.
That's Danone yogurt.
That's right. So I'm saying there should be at least one more type of business to, in order to justify the totality of human being. This is a business dedicated to others, not to yourself. The current business is all dedicated to myself. Everything, I'm in the center of my business. I gain. So I'm reversing that, creating another business, calling social business, that's dedicated to others completely and nothing for me. So it's kind of coming together. We can create those kind of businesses where it's a non-loss, non-dividend company with a social objective. We created several companies, one of them that you mentioned, Grameen Danone Company. Danone is a big yogurt company, a big water company, and so on. But we created a small company in Bangladesh in collaboration with Grameen. This is designed as a social business. The company produces yogurt, but for a specific purpose, to bring nutrition to the malnourished children of Bangladesh. All the micronutrients which are missing in those millions of children in Bangladesh are put into this yogurt, the vitamin, iron, zinc, whatever is missing, into the yogurt. And it's a fortified yogurt, and make it very cheap so that the poorest children can afford it. And once they eat this as a snack, because it's a delicious snack, they eat, they love it, so gradually they will regain the health. The company promised that they will not take any dividend. Grameen will not take any dividend out of it, and Danone will not take any dividend out of it. Entire thing is dedicated to the social objective. So this becomes an example of social business. We can create healthcare programs. For example, in the United States, 47 million people don't have health insurance. We can create a social business to bring social health insurance to those people. Because money profit-maximizing companies don't want to get there because they have better alternative to make money rather than giving health insurance to the people who cannot afford it. So we said this is a case for a social business. Many people don't receive health care programs in many, many countries around the world. We can create social businesses. There are many diseases in the world, very tough diseases like cholera, typhoid, where the vaccines are available in designs. The whole invention has been made, but it's not produced because it doesn't make money. So with a social business, we can create the cholera vaccines, we can create the typhoid vaccine. There are six such what they call orphan diseases, where the vaccines are available in designs, but nobody produces it because it doesn't serve the poor people. I mean, it doesn't serve the interest of the business.
And those diseases are?
I cannot give you the whole list. I can mention two. One is typhoid, another is cholera.
In this country, are there social businesses that you've been involved with?
Not yet, just beginning. One, we created Grameen America as a social business because we want to bring the financial services to people who go to the check cashing companies. Millions of people in this country cannot open a bank account because banks will not consider them worthwhile to open a bank account for them. They are too small for them. So they cannot open a bank account. When they receive a check from their employer, from the government, they have to go to the check cashing companies and pay for very dearly to get their check cashed. Their $1,000 check should have generated $1,000. That doesn't do it now, because they cannot have a bank account. So we want to open that. And there are many, many payday loans. You see the advertisements and the commercials in the newspapers and televisions, payday loans. It don't have to be. And you pay high interest rate on payday loans. This is another way of ripping you off. So because financial institutions, formal financial institutions, don't come into it, there are lots of pawn shops around. So we said, well, we can address that by designing a financial system in a social businesses and address that. So we created this Grameen America and started in Queens, in Jackson Heights, in New York. Once we develop the prototype, we can take it everywhere. That's what we're looking for. And there are many more. The social business fund, we are creating a social business fund. Those who would like to invest in social businesses in the United States, as elsewhere, in terms of health insurance, in terms of microcredit, in terms of financial services, in terms of housing, this is the fund will be available, whoever can come up with a brilliant idea. Because it's a question of designing an innovative idea in a social business to address all the problems we see around us.
Mohamed Yunus, I wanted to switch gears a bit. In your acceptance speech for the Nobel in Oslo in 2006, you said poverty is a threat to peace. You also criticized the Bush administration's so-called war on terror.
Till now, over $530 billion has been spent on the war in Iraq by the USA alone. I believe terrorism cannot be won by the military action. Terrorism must be condemned in the strongest possible language. We must stand solidly against it and find all the means to end it. We must address the root cause of terrorism to end terrorism for all time to come. I believe that putting resources into improving the lives of the poor is a better strategy than spending it on guns.
Mohammed Yunus in Oslo receiving the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize, the effect of the war in Iraq.
Okay. Yeah, it's my first comment would be, we started this millennium, 2000, it's a tremendous amount of euphoria, tremendous amount of excitement. Cold War is out and things are taking into shape. Now we can put our resources, our attention, our policies to solve the problems of poverty, diseases, and all those things. And we adopted in the Millennium Summit in New York City, the Millennium Development Goals, beautiful goals. For the first time in human history, all the nations of the world got together and decided that we want to reduce poverty by half by 2015, in 15 years' time. It's a tremendous amount of exciting decision. And this was a starting point. And a few years later, a couple of years later, we start with war. War on terror, and all our resources, all our attention, all our discussions are concentrating on terrorism. Forget about what it's all about. So we derailed ourselves completely about creating a new millennium, creating a new society, changing the world, and with the technology coming in, with all kinds of brilliant things on the table, we could have done that. But we completely removed ourselves. Billions of dollars went into a war, which we have not achieved anything. Terrorism didn't disappear. I said, terrorism, you have to address the basic issues of terrorism. If there's a frustrations among people for something, either it's an economic frustrations or it's a political frustrations or some a sense of deprivation that we are not being listened to, terrorism, it will be good breeding ground for terrorism. So why don't we address those issues, political issues, economic issues, rather than bring the gun? Gun cannot stop terrorism. It only put the terrorism underground for a while. It will come back in a more frightening way. So instead of trying to conquer it by guns, why don't we go with a human problem, solve it in a human way, address those issues and solve them one by one, piece by piece. It could be done. With all the goodwill in the world, we could do that. So this is what I would say the most damaging thing that we have done so far.
What is your assessment of President Bush's effect on the world?
Well, he has created a very negative image of the United States. People have not much respect in the rest of the world about the leadership because, you like it or not, the United States is the leader of the whole world because of your technology, because of your financial power, your leadership and innovations and so on. And people look forward to you to lead them, lead the whole world. Now, people don't look forward to look at you because you led them into wrong things. So people are kind of looking at the United States in a very suspicious way. That is it good for us? Or they are leading us to more difficult things. So that's how I think the Bush administration will be remembered, that it has created a lot of question marks in people's minds around the world about the leadership of the United States.
Well, we're going to have to end on that question mark. I thank you very much for being with us. Mohammed Yunus, Nobel Peace Prize laureate. He has written a new book. His first was Banker to the Poor, Microlending and the Battle Against World Poverty. His new book is Creating a World Without Poverty, Social Business and the Future of Capitalism. Mohammed Yunus, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now! It's produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Aramate, Anjali Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Robbie Caron, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, and Peter Curries, our engineers. Special thanks also to Becca Staley and Hugh Grant and Samantha Chambly. We have a job opening. It is a TV producer full-time here in Manhattan. Go to our website, democracynow.org, and send in your resume. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.